Good evening for WBAI News in New York. I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Tuesday, April 4th, 2017. In another bizarre ramble, Donald Trump today went back to his scenario of how he won the election.
We ran the coast. And if you don't run it, you can't win. Huge disadvantage, the Electoral College. It's very, very tough. They say almost impossible for a Republican to win. But I had the support of, I would say almost everybody in this room. We had tremendous support. No, we did. We had tremendous support.
Trump spoke today at the North America's Building Trades Union National Legislative Conference. He defended his immigration policy in front of members of the building trade.
We're also going to protect your jobs by protecting our borders. My administration is just a matter of weeks, literally a short period of time, has brought record reductions to illegal immigration. Record reductions. Down 61% since inauguration. General Kelly is doing a fantastic job.
Then Trump the Builder took over speaking against federal regulations, saying it's about time we have a builder in the White House.
To achieve true progress, we must remember our legacy. We're the nation that built the tallest skyscrapers on what was once the Hudson River and put neon lights of Las Vegas in the desert. But if government continues to punish America's builders, then we will not be that nation any longer. I'm calling on all Americans, Democrat, Republican, Independent, to come together and take part in the great rebuilding of our country. That is why in my address to Congress, I called on lawmakers to pass legislation that produces a $1 trillion investment in the infrastructure of our country, and we need it.
Donald Trump at the 2017 North America's Building Trade Unions National Legislative Conference in Washington, D.C. Back home, as Ben Max of Gotham Gazette tells us, there's much confusion in New York this week around a new state budget in Albany.
Governor Andrew Cuomo and legislative leaders missed the Friday midnight budget deadline ahead of the start of the new fiscal year Saturday, April 1st. However, on Monday, Cuomo sent the legislature what's known as budget extender bills, which were passed, and the state continues to run and has enough operating funds for 2 months. However, the budget extender leaves a lot of questions unanswered and leaves municipalities, including New York City, with a lot of uncertainty, as Mayor Bill de Blasio said on Monday. And as Cuomo and state legislative leaders debated what will be about $150 billion fiscal year budget, they were hung up on a couple of key issues, including affordable housing funding and policy, and what's known as raise the age, which would raise the age of criminal responsibility in New York from 16 to potentially 18. New York is one of only two states in the country that still has the age of adult criminal responsibility as 16. So unable to reach a deal by the Friday midnight deadline, on Monday, the extender bill allocates $24.6 billion for state operating funds through May 31st. It also included $16.4 billion in capital appropriations for Governor Cuomo's key economic development and infrastructure projects, which have been a signature of Cuomo's second term thus far. And while those $40 billion in funding are now in place and state employees are getting paid and state operations continue, negotiations also continue in the Capitol, and on Tuesday, Wednesday, and beyond, Governor Cuomo and legislative leaders will continue to debate a bigger budget for the full fiscal year, which would include new estimates on funding to localities around things like education aid and affordable housing grants. Another element of all the uncertainty for both Cuomo and the legislature, as well as city funding, is what's happening with the federal budget. And Cuomo indicated that in the statement he released when the negotiators reached an impasse on the state budget. The federal budget picture will be more clear in late May, and that's part of the reason Cuomo chose a May 31st deadline for this extender. We'll see, though, if the state decides to go ahead with a full budget plan before then that negates the extender and creates a fiscal year 2017-2018 state budget plan, which could potentially then be itself adjusted once the federal budget plan is more clear in the fall. Now, there is more happening in New York politics than just the state budget, although that's looming over everything and everybody. Speaking of Mayor de Blasio, he's actually out of town as of Tuesday afternoon. He's on a West Coast trip that combines both government meetings with West Coast mayors in Seattle, San Francisco, and elsewhere, and fundraisers for the mayor's reelection campaign. De Blasio is facing reelection this fall in a September primary and November general election. Meanwhile, back here in the city, there are several interesting events to keep an eye on this week. Those include City Comptroller Scott Stringer hosting a town hall meeting on the Upper West Side Thursday evening. Also Thursday evening, former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara will deliver a lecture at Cooper Union in what will be a must-see event. And then as the City Council continues its city budget deliberations, there are also a variety of committee hearings this week on policy issues and oversight hearings. As City Council committees on public safety, parks and recreation, mental health and youth services, and a variety of others hold hearings at City Hall. You can see our full rundown at Gotham Gazette. For WBAI News New York, this is Ben Max.
Debate on Trump's Supreme Court nominee continues. Republican and Democratic leaders are casting blame. Democrats secured the votes to block the nomination. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, though, is poised to change a longstanding Senate rule to confirm Neil Gorsuch. McConnell says a partisan filibuster is unprecedented. Democrats, though, note that the GOP blocked former President Barack Obama's nominee for the court last year by not giving him a hearing. Dick Durbin is Democratic whip from Illinois. Today, he reminded Republicans why Democrats are so upset over the Neil Gorsuch nomination, particularly because of the way the nominee Judge Merrick Garland was treated the previous year. And he reminds the committee where the name Neil Gorsuch came from, the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society committed to originalism financed by the Koch brothers and the Mercer family. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin.
We shouldn't be entertaining Neil Gorsuch this week. We ought to be celebrating the first anniversary of Merrick Garland's service on the U.S. Supreme Court. The reason we're not, Senator McConnell and the Senate Republicans refused us that opportunity. They said, no, you can't vote on it. Remember their logic? The logic was, wait a minute, this is the last year of President Obama's presidency. Why should he be able to fill a vacancy on the Supreme Court when we have an election coming soon? Interesting argument. Two things I'm troubled with. I do believe President Obama was elected for 4 years in his second term, not three, which meant he had authority in the fourth year as he did in the third year. Secondly, the Republican argument ignores history. It ignores the obvious history. When we had a situation with President Ronald Reagan in his last year in office with a vacancy on the Supreme Court, and the Democrats in charge of the Senate, and the Democrats in charge of the Senate Judiciary Committee, President Ronald Reagan, a lame duck president in his last year, nominated Anthony Kennedy to serve on the court, sent the name to the Democratic Senate, where there was a hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee and a vote that sent him to the court. You never hear that story, do you, from Senator McConnell? Because it doesn't fit into his playbook as to why he would wait for a year and refuse to give Merrick Garland a hearing and a vote. The reasoning is obvious. Clearly, he was banking on the possibility that the electorate would choose a Republican president. And that's what happened. So that a Republican president, in this case Donald Trump, could fill the vacancy, not Barack Obama. So when I hear the speeches on the floor by Senator McConnell about his bipartisan cooperation, he leaves out an important chapter, the last chapter, the one that brought us to this moment in the United States Senate. And I look at the situation before us today, and it's a sad situation for the Senate. Sad in that we have reached the point now where the Supreme Court nomination has become so political, more so than any time in history. Where did the name Neil Gorsuch come from for the Supreme Court? Well, it came from a list prepared by two organizations, the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation. These are both Republican advocacy groups representing special interest, funded by special interest, who came up with the names and gave them to presidential candidate Donald Trump. It was a list of 21 names. He issued them twice, in March and in September of the last campaign year. And Neil Gorsuch's name was on the list. The Federalist Society was created in 1982. It nominally is an organization that is committed to originalism. In other words, look to the clear meaning of the Constitution, what the Founding Fathers meant. They say that over and over again. We'll just look to the Constitution and read it, and then we'll know what we should do. That was in a speech that was given by Edwin Meese, then Attorney General in 1985, explaining the Federalist Society credo. On its face, it sounds at least arguably defensible that there would be an organization that is so committed to the Constitution that it wants Supreme Court nominees that will follow it as literally as possible. But as Justice William Brennan on the Supreme Court said, if they think they can find in those musty volumes back in the 18th century all the answers to all the questions on the issues that we face today, here's what he called it. That's arrogance posing as humility. Arrogance posing as humility. But that's what they said the Federalist Society was all about. If that were all that the Federalist Society was about, then I guess you could argue they ought to have their day in court, their day in choosing someone for the Supreme Court. But it's more than that. When you look at those who finance the Federalist Society, and it's a short list because they refuse to disclose their donors, when you look at those who support the Federalist Society, the classic names of Republican support, the Koch brothers, the Mercer family, the Richard Mellon Scaife Family Foundation, the ones who pop up over and over and over again. Why would these organizations be so determined to pick the next nominee to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court? Because there's so much at stake. My colleague Sheldon Whitehouse at a Judiciary Committee hearing went through the box score when it came to the Supreme Court and how they ruled when given a choice between special interest and corporate elites, average workers and consumers and families. And as Senator Whitehouse has pointed out, graphically in detail, overwhelmingly, this court has ruled for the special interest. 69% of their rulings in favor of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce position on issues. So why would a special interest organization like the Federalist Society care? They want to keep a good thing going from their point of view. And that's why this is a different Supreme Court nominee. Mr. President, I yield the floor.
Illinois Senator Dick Durbin. Federalist Society members on the U.S. Supreme Court include Justices Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas, Chief Justice John Roberts, and former Chief Justice Antonin Scalia.
My name is Robert Arnaud. I'm a graphic designer, and I live in Brooklyn.
New Yorkers at a recent People's Filibuster Coalition rally at Foley Square spoke about Neil Gorsuch and why he's wrong for the Supreme Court.
The courts are supposed to be used to adjudicate disputes fairly. And unfortunately, what we've seen over the past 15 years or so is that there's a faction in this country that has put partisans on the Supreme Court, and they've ruled overwhelmingly in the interests of big corporations, the 1%, against the interests of regular people. And I get that that's going to happen sometimes, but it shouldn't be happening so unanimously across the board. And additionally, this has been happening in relation to election-related disputes where they consistently rule in favor of the Republican Party.
This is Joe Dinkin, National Communications Director of the Working Families Party from Brooklyn, New York. We're part of this event, part of the People's Filibuster Coalition, because we believe that Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court would threaten everything we hold dear, from women's health to the role of big money in politics to even, you know, allowing Trump's unconstitutional Muslim ban. So we're here to fight Trump with everything we can, fight to stop Neil Gorsuch from ever making it onto the Supreme Court. And the way we're doing that is by demanding that Democrats in the Senate across America stand united and filibuster Trump's nominee Neil Gorsuch.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders says there's no way he can vote for Neil Gorsuch. He says there's no way he can support a man with Gorsuch's views for a lifetime seat on the Supreme Court. He thinks Gorsuch would vote in support of corporate interests against the needs of working people in this country, that he wouldn't stand up for voting rights, that he would vote against Roe and in favor of Citizens United, and he sees a host of other problems. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders.
The Supreme Court is the most important judicial body in this country. The decisions that it reaches, even on a 5-4 vote, have a profound impact on all Americans, on our environment, and on our way of life. As we decide this week as to how we are going to cast our votes regarding Judge Gorsuch, it is important to understand how that vote for Judge Gorsuch, for or against him, will impact the lives of the people of our country. Let me give you just a few examples as to what is at stake. 7 years ago, in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled in a case called Citizens United. And in that case, by a 5-4 decision, the court said that billionaires and corporations could spend as much money as they wanted on the political process. This decision, as all Americans know, opened the floodgates of corporate money, of money from the billionaire class, such that the wealthiest people in our country today can now elect candidates who represent their interests and not the interests of ordinary Americans. That decision, Citizens United, is undermining American democracy, and in my view, is moving us toward an oligarchic form of society in which a handful of the wealthiest people in this country, the Koch brothers and others, now have the power not only to control our economy, but our political life as well. In my view, Citizens United must be overturned, and we must move back to a nation where our political system is based on one person, one vote, not on the ability of billionaires to buy elections. Based on my conversation with Judge Gorsuch and a review of his record, do I believe that he will vote to overturn Citizens United? Absolutely not. Further, I suspect that he will vote to undermine our democracy even further by supporting the elimination of all restrictions on campaign finance, something which the Republican leadership in this body wants. What the Republican leadership is striving towards is eliminating all campaign finance restrictions such that billionaires can say to somebody, I'm going to give you $500 million to run for the U.S. Senate from California, and you work for me. No independent expenditures. I will select your campaign manager, your speechwriter, your media advisor, your pollster. You are my employee. That is what Republican leadership here wants. They want to undermine all campaign finance laws that on campaign finance. And I believe that Judge Gorsuch will move this country in that way, a more and more undemocratic way. Further, when we talk about the political process, it's important to point out that in 2013, again, by a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court gutted the 1965 historic Voting Rights Act, a law which was passed to combat racial discrimination in voting in a number of states. What the court said, finally, is that in the United States, you have the right to vote no matter what the color of your skin is. An historic step forward in making this country the kind of country that it must be become. Well, as a result of that 5-4 Supreme Court decision in 2013, gutting the Voting Rights Act, literally days after, we had Republican governors and Republican legislatures all over this country, under the guise of fighting voter fraud, passing laws intentionally, everybody knows this, intentionally designed to make it harder for people of color, for poor people, for young people, for older people to vote in elections. In America in the year 2017, it is not too much to ask that all of our people who are eligible to vote be able to vote without harassment, without roadblocks, without barriers being placed in front of them. I know it is a radical idea, Mr. President, but it's called democracy. It's called democracy. It says that if you are eligible to vote, we want you to vote. We want you to participate. It says that in America, when we have one of the lowest voter turnout rates of any major country on earth, we want more people to be participating in the political process, not fewer people. Mr. President, there is nothing that I have seen in Judge Gorsuch's record or in his recent statements to suggest to me that he is prepared to overturn this disastrous decision on the Voting Rights Act. Mr. President, in 1973, as we all know, the Supreme Court decided Roe versus Wade and declared that women have a constitutional right to control their own bodies. That decision has been subsequently affirmed by multiple cases as recently as last June. In his confirmation hearings, Judge Gorsuch refused to state if he believed Roe v. Wade was good law and should be upheld. Based on his statements and general philosophy, I believe there is a strong likelihood that Judge Gorsuch would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade and deny the women of this country the constitutional right to control their own bodies. This would be an outrage, and I do not want to be a party to allowing that to happen. In addition, under Chief Justice John Roberts, the Supreme Court has time and time again voted in support of corporate interests and against the needs of the working people of our country. After reviewing Judge Gorsuch's record, I believe that he will continue that trend.
And Sanders spoke against the so-called nuclear option, GOP tactic to override a filibuster and confirm Gorsuch with a simple majority of 51 votes, not the 60 votes currently needed in the 100-member chamber. Senator Sanders said to Republicans, instead of changing the rule, change the nominee. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Civil rights groups are reacting with alarm after the Trump administration has signaled that it may back out of federal agreements designed to force many local police departments to curb brutality and racial bias. The nation's largest police union welcomes the move. Baltimore police are ready for reforms despite a request for delay. Investigators are searching for possible accomplices of a 22-year-old native of the Central Asian country of Kyrgyzstan, identified as the suicide bomber in the St. Petersburg subway, as residents come to grips with the first major terrorist attack in Russia's second-largest city since the Soviet collapse. Officials are treating this as an act of terrorism. If there is a link, Moscow's role in Syria's war will come under the spotlight, according to Reuters Moscow bureau chief Christian Lowe.
Since Russia started using its aircraft to bomb targets in Syria and support Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Islamic State has repeatedly, through its propaganda arms and its own websites, issued threats to Russia and said that Russia will be made to pay.
The founder of the Fox News channel was forced out in a sexual harassment scandal. The network's number one on-air personality, Bill O'Reilly, has been accused of crude and vindictive behavior with women so often that the National Organization for Women is demanding that he be fired. The NCAA has reluctantly once again agreed to consider North Carolina as a host for the championship events after the state rolled back a law that limited protections for LGBT people. The NCAA says the new law meets the minimal NCAA requirements. The White House is struggling to revive the derailed Republican health care overhaul. Proposed changes, though, draw an uneven reception in Congress, leaving the rescue mission's fate uncertain. And the IRS is resuming use of private debt collectors amid a wave of telephone scams in which the fake IRS agents tell innocent taxpayers to pay up or face jail. Today, April 4th, marks 50 years after Martin Luther King's speech, Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence. It's a speech that recognized the urgent need to end militarism and war. Code Pink on this anniversary says Dr. King called for a revolution of values, and with the Trump administration's budget proposing to take an extra $54 billion from urgent social and environmental needs to feed the already bloated Pentagon, we certainly need a revolution of values, says Code Pink. The Reverend William Barber came to New York City from North Carolina to revisit Dr. King's message on Sunday at the Riverside Church. Reverend Dr. William Barber is with Repairers of the Breach, architect of Moral Mondays, and president of the NAACP in North Carolina. Reverend Barber.
Dr. King declared we needed a moral revolution in 67. And if we needed a moral revolution in 67, God knows we need a moral revival today. We need a political Pentecost where we regain our speech and we learn once again how to talk in the tongues of justice and love and mercy, that we can challenge the narrative of the forces of oppression. We have to begin to reframe the conversation, not to talk about left policies and right policies, but let's talk about violence versus nonviolence. You know how Coretta Scott King said it. She said, listen, poverty can produce violence. She said, starving a child is violence. Suppressing a culture is violence. Neglecting school children is violence. Discrimination against a working person is violence. Ghetto housing is violence. Ignoring people's medical needs is violence. Contempt for equality is violence. And even a lack of willpower to do anything or say anything to help humanity is a sick and sinister form of violence. So the question for us today is, are we going to be on the side of violence or nonviolence? I choose nonviolence. Silence. Silence is not an option you can choose anymore.
The Reverend William Barber at Riverside Church in New York City. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, April 4th, 2017. The news was produced with Ben Max, Ekim Killick, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
Go out and tell our story. Let it echo far and wide. Make them hear you. Make them hear you. How justice was our battle, and how justice was denied. Make them hear you. Make them hear you. And say to those who blame us for the way we chose to fight, that sometimes there are battles that are more than black or white. And I could not put
justice was my right. Make them hear you. Go out and tell our story to your daughters and your sons. Make them hear you. Make them hear you. And tell them in our struggle we were not the only ones. Make them hear you. Make them hear you.